Good morning again, everyone. So I'd like to call to order this conference committee on House File 2128. I see that Representative Schultz is here. I did hear from Senator Benson that she's in transit. Oh, I do see she's here. So, okay, she was going to be having some difficulty for a little bit at the start here. So good. We will start then by calling the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would call the roll for us, please.
Liebling.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Gomez.
Present.
Pinto. Pinto. Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Benson.
Present.
Abler. Dutke.
Present.
Fran.
Present.
Hoffman.
Hoffman present.
All right. Present. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. And I know that Senator Abler was we know that he's not going to be able to join us this morning. And actually, because of that, we've made a slight adjustment. We initially were going to go through Article 2 of the House bill, which is the licensing and background studies. But then we realized that those are really falling in Senator Abler's part of the bill. So we're going to defer that. And we're going to go today through House Article 4, Senate 3, which is the health boards. We'll go through House Article 5, Senate Article 4, which is prescription drugs. And we'll go through House Article 7, Senate Article 8, which is telehealth. So that is the plan for today. And let's see if there's anything else I need to let you all know. So okay, and I'm sure that Representative Pinto will be joining us. I haven't heard that he's not, so very good. Okay, so the first article on the agenda then would be House Article 4, and I see Ms. Sunderman is with us. Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair, members, I'll be going through House Article 4, which is the health-related licensing boards, and it's Senate Article 3, health occupations and health-related licensing boards.
Okay, and Ms. Sunderman, your voice is kind of soft coming across to me. I don't know if that's true for other people, but if you could, be a bit closer to the mic, that's great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, starting with Senate Sections 1 through 12 and Sections 23 and 24, these are Senate only, and these sections make changes to the credentialing process for emergency medical responders, EMTs, AEMTs, and paramedics. Moving to House Sections 1 and 2, these sections are House only, and they make changes to the Minnesota Psychology Practice Act by requiring at least two members of the board to reside outside the metro area, and at least two members to be members of a community of color or an underrepresented community. They also require at least four of the required continuing education hours to be on specified diversity training that's detailed in the bill. And these and the rest of the House sections relate to the mental health professional workforce and cultural competency provisions. Sections 13 through 17 of the Senate are Senate only. They make changes to the doula registry by permitting the Commissioner of Health to designate doula certification organizations. Sections 3 and 4 of the House are House only. They make similar changes as to the Psychology Practice Act, but for the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, requiring changes to the board makeup and adding four required continuing education hours on the specified diversity training. Sections 5 and 6 are House only. They make similar changes, but this time to the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. They require at least 3 members of the board to reside outside the metro area and 3 to be members of community of color or underrepresented community. And again, 4 hours of continuing education on diversity training. Section 7 through 9 are house only as well. They make changes to the Board of Social Work Practice Act by adding a definition of cultural responsiveness and requiring at least 4 hours of new continuing education on cultural responsiveness. Senate sections 18 through 22 and section 24 are Senate only. They modify the Board of Pharmacy statutes to create separate licenses for medical gas manufacturers, medical gas wholesalers, and medical gas dispensers. Section 10 is House only. However, the provision passed the Senate floor and is in the Senate Agriculture Omnibus Bill. This is the creating an exemption from the practice of veterinary medicine for EMTs who provide emergency care to police dogs. And finally, House Section 11 is House only, and it is also related to the workforce and cultural competency bill, and it requires certain mental health licensing boards to develop recommendations for a certification process for supervisors in the mental health fields. And that concludes the article.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Sunderman. So I just want to let members know that Senator Benson and I had a discussion of this, some of this last night. And the provision that Ms. Sunderman just mentioned, the in our bill, it's house only, is section 10 of this article, the police dog piece, which is in the Board of Veterinary Medicine. So the Senate has this in their ag bill. And we've had a discussion with the ag committee on our side. So we're in agreement. Senator Benson and I are going to have this move to, this will be negotiated in the ag committee. So we won't need to worry too much about that here. And, you know, just so everyone's aware, there's some, it seemed very simple when it came through our committees, and there's been a bit of complication with the Board of Veterinary Medicine has some concerns about it now, but those will be worked out in the Ag Committee. Okay, and then also Senator Benson and I discussed last night many of the provisions in this article that are House-only provisions that Ms. Sunderman just went through relate to a bill on diversifying the mental health workforce. And this was from Representative Vang, and we hope to be able to have a separate discussion and have Representative Vang come and speak to us about her bill and what she's trying to accomplish, because these are only a few of the provisions in it. It's spread across different areas. So it would probably be helpful for us to understand what she's trying to do in a more holistic way. And we hope to do that. And also, I think NAMI has a lot of interest in this bill, and we hope to have them come in as well. So just for those members, particularly in the Senate, who may not be familiar with what we're trying to do here, that's our intention, is to try to bring you up to speed in a more holistic way at a later time. Okay, so are there questions for members or comments at this point before we go on to the next article?
Chair Liebling, I'm just going to come off mute and affirm for everyone that what you represented is what we had talked about last night. And so I look forward to Representative Vang, NAMI representatives, and representatives from the various boards coming to testify before the committee.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Great. Okay. So now I think we're going to turn to House Article 5, and I see Mr. Chun is going to present that one for us. Sure. Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair and members, Randy Chun with House Research. So this is House Article 5, Prescription Drugs, and Senate Article 4, Prescription Drugs and Opiates. So the first set of sections, this is House Section 1 from Article 12 and Senate Section 1 from this article. These deal with the opiate epidemic response fund. It's a clarification related to a deposit into the opiate epidemic response fund of settlement payments from consulting firms that work for opioid manufacturers and wholesalers. So the two bodies take different approaches. The House strikes the specific reference to opioid manufacturers and wholesalers so that the language would apply to opioid settlements generally, whereas the Senate adds specific references to the current law to consulting firms that work for an opioid manufacturer or wholesaler. Then the next set of sections, sections 1-6 and 13-14 of the House, this is the House only provision. They prohibit manufacturers from imposing excessive price increases on generic or off-patent drugs and from withdrawing a drug from sale in the state to avoid this prohibition. So it requires state agencies to notify the manufacturer, the Attorney General, and the Board of Pharmacy of excessive price increases. And then it allows the Attorney General to take action against these violations and petition the court for various remedies. And it also makes violations grounds for disciplinary action by the Board of Pharmacy. Then the next section, this is Senate Section 2, Senate only. This creates incentives for drug manufacturers to use the importation pathway for certain prescription drug products that meet federal importation guidelines. The next section is House Section 7. This requires health carriers to offer at least 25% of their individual and small group insurance offerings with a pre-deductible flat dollar copayment for drugs. So this is a House-only provision. Next two sections, House Section 8 and then House Section 20. These deal with formulary transparency. They require health plan companies to make their formularies available 30 days before annual renewal dates. They limit the extent to which drugs can be removed during an enrollee's contract term, and also provides that certain changes that would increase the cost to an enrollee would not apply for the duration of the contract term. And it requires DHS managed care plans to comply with this requirement, but exempt CGIP coverage. So this is House only. Then the next set of sections, House Sections 9, 11, 12, and 21. These deal with biological products. They limit the extent to which a PBM or a health carrier can give preferential treatment to a single biological product. It basically states that if a PBM or health carrier does this, it has to provide equivalent coverage to a reference, biosimilar, or interchangeable biological product with the wholesale acquisition cost that is less than that first product. And then Section 21 requires the Commissioner of Health to study the effect of these requirements on the net price of biological products and report to the legislature. Next section, this would be House Section 10, Senate Section 3. This is dealing with the gag clause. It prohibits a PBM or health carrier from prohibiting a pharmacy from discussing drug acquisition costs and reimbursement with a patient. Also prohibits a PBM from prohibiting a pharmacy from discussing reimbursement information with a health carrier. This language is identical in both bills. Next sections are Senate Sections 4-6. These decrease the licensure fees for medical gas manufacturers and wholesalers from $5,260 to $260, a Senate-only provision. Next section is Senate Section 7. It exempts opiates used for medication-assisted therapy for substance use disorder from being calculated as opiate units when determining whether a manufacturer is subject to the annual opiate registration fee. It's a Senate-only provision. Then sections 15 and 22 of the House deal with temperature requirements for drugs, requires mail order and specialty pharmacies to comply with manufacturer temperature requirements when mailing a drug, and also to develop policies and procedures consistent with some national standards. And section 22 requires the Board of Pharmacy to report to the legislature on requiring in each shipment a method of detecting improper storage or temperature violations. So this is house only. Then house sections 16 to 19, Senate sections 8 to 11 deal with the drug repository program. They make changes in the operation of this program, including allowing donation of over-the-counter drugs and allowing the sharing of inventories with other state donation programs. The language is identical. Then House Article 12, Section 19 is compared with Senate Section 12. These deal with appropriations from the Opiate Epidemic Response Fund and their differences. They just do different things. The House requires funds for social service agencies and certain grants to be distributed on a calendar year basis. And the Senate just keeps current law, which is a fiscal year distribution. And then the Senate makes a conforming change in this section that, along with the Senate rider, would make funding for the results first evaluations and the ECHO projects ongoing. Next section is Article 1, Section 11 of the Senate bill. This specifies that any funds received by the state as a result of a settlement agreement with a consulting firm that works for an opioid manufacturer wholesaler would count toward the $250 million amount that triggers the sunset of the opiate licensing fees and the opiate registration fee. So this is Senate only. Next section is Senate Section 13. This exempts injectable opiate products that are distributed at a hospital or hospital pharmacy from being counted as opiate units when determining whether a manufacturer has to pay the opiate registration fee that is due on June 20th of 2021. And it requires Department of Management and Budget to transfer into the Opiate Epidemic Response Fund an amount equal to the estimated revenue loss from this exemption. And that concludes the drug articles.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chun. I do have one question for you on just about the sheet here, and mm-hmm. you know, recognizing that these are, as was mentioned by Mr. Monahan yesterday, these might not be 100% accurate. That these summaries that we're working off of for purposes of the going through this quickly. In Senate Section 4-6 about decreasing the license fees, mm-hmm. there's no indication that this is a has a cost.
Okay.
And I assume that it must, right? I don't see how it, no?
Yep. Okay. You know, Madam Chair, that might be something that we just missed. I think it's something we're just going to have to check.
Okay. Ms. Kavanaugh is shaking her head. Welcome, please.
Madam Chair, as this was going through the Senate, the board was specifically said that it would not have a cost. These are just rearranging the licensures that are already in statute, but they're pulling them out and having a separate license for all of them. So they're not paying any, you know, the license fee is not being increased or decreased for these specific entities. It's basically just creating a separate license for each of these.
Ms. Kavanaugh, you might be talking about a different provision than I am.
Senate Section 4-6. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. It would have a decrease in the opiate epidemic fund revenue, but not in the general fund or the state government special revenue fund.
Okay, that was my question, because I don't know how you can decrease a fee by that much and not have it have a fiscal impact. So it's just an omission on the sheet here, and I'm sure it's on the spreadsheet as well. Mr. Berg could probably confirm that, but I'm sure it's accounted for somewhere. But okay, good to know. All right. So there's a lot in these couple of articles to talk about, I think, and I don't know if members want to have that discussion now or if they're prepared to. But are there questions for members about any of the items on the sheet? here on the, in the prescription drug and opiates article. And we do have Dr. Weiberg here from the Board of Pharmacy. I saw he came on camera for a moment there. He's available to answer questions. And there are some, obviously, some big differences between the House and Senate in some of these provisions. Okay, not seeing any questions from members. I'd like to ask a question, and I don't know if any of the members on the, any of the senators are, you know, if you're not prepared, this might not be in your area to answer, but some of the Senate provisions refer to, like, for example, Senate Section 1, where Mr. Chun said there are different approaches. The Senate adds references to consulting firms working for an opioid manufacturer. And there's another provision also where consulting firms are mentioned. And I wonder if any of the senators can explain, or maybe it would, maybe Mr. Dr. Weiberg, I don't, or somebody else could explain kind of what that's about. This is not an area I have a lot of familiarity in, and why the references to consulting firms.
Madam Chair,
Senator Benson, yes.
When the McKinsey settlement came through, we were concerned that it wasn't wrapped into the other opioid settlements. And so that's why the specific consulting firm language, but if there was broader language that captured the same intent, we would be open to that. But we use the consulting firm revenue, the consulting firm settlement revenue to offset some of the reductions under medical gases, et cetera, so that the fund isn't overall harmed by some of those changes. So that's why consulting firm is there specifically.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions about that? I have to say, I probably need more on that because the whole thing, again, you know, I think the House has handled this separately than in a different way than the Senate, and the folks who are more knowledgeable about this piece and about the opioid settlements, I don't think any of us on the conference committee are, were among those who did the work on this. So this is not as familiar to me as perhaps it should be. So, okay, well, that being the case, and, you know, we, I don't want to fail to use our time here. So, you know, maybe we can just go kind of, I'll just go back through this a little bit and say a few words about some of the House provisions and see if that provokes any discussion or any questions from members. So, you know, just going on the front of the sheet here in House sections 1-6 and 13 and 14, what Mr. Chun read here, prohibiting drug manufacturers from imposing excessive prices on generic or off-patent drugs, et cetera. This is what we call the price gouging bill. It's being carried by Representative Stevenson in the House. And this is one of the House approaches to the very serious problem of high pharmaceutical prices, which I probably don't need to describe to anybody on this call, the impact that that has on a lot of Minnesotans who, you know, it's a terrible irony if you can get to your doctor and get a prescription to help you with your problem and then not be able to afford the drugs that are prescribed. Or for people with chronic conditions, this is often just a terrible problem. And we've seen some very arbitrary kinds of price increases that don't seem to be related to anything. So this is an approach to trying to get some control over those prices and just to say to the manufacturers that we're not going to tolerate this anymore, that we're going to stand up for our citizens here in Minnesota. One thing I probably should note is that the reason that this is only for generic drugs, and Mr. Chun can help me out here, I think, if I'm a little bit off on this, but apparently there's a lawsuit that, or a court case, I should say, that limits our ability to do this in the non-generic drug space, or maybe actually maybe Dr. Weiberg, you might be the person who could address this piece if you would.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And I actually have to say, I did not have much involvement in this issue. It kind of really goes beyond what the board's purview is. And I am not quite sure why the language was drafted as it is. Sorry.
Okay. Mr. Yeah. Chun, how about you? Can you help me out a little bit here, because this was obviously, it's not my bill, but I'm pretty sure that the issue was having to do with a court case that we were only able to go so far.
Madam Chair, I also don't know the details of this, but my understanding is that it was limited to the generics for reasons, I guess, to make the state law, I suppose, more defendable in case there were future legal challenges. I'm afraid I don't know the details.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Senator Benson, I don't know if you're in a good spot now where you would be able to talk about the importation pathway section. My understanding is that was your bill. Okay, I think she might have dropped off there for a moment. Maybe she's getting into her office and getting onto Zoom. That would be so. Maybe we could. Oh, there she is.
I was running down the hallway. Thank goodness the host muted me. To the price gouging. There was a case in Maryland about this, a similar provision, that the key provision was that a state can't impose price controls on another state. And by setting price limits in Minnesota, we would require the manufacturers to have separate prices. And nationally, they're allowed to have one price, an NDC, I think it's called. And so we would be interfering with interstate commerce. So I think that's the key provision of the Maryland case.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I know this is something that the Attorney General is very interested in. And I think that our advice on that probably came from them. But Senator, if you're I don't know if you need a moment to get settled there, if you would be able to talk to us about your drug importation pathway piece that's in section, Senate section 2.
Absolutely. What this does, this was put through in the previous administration. Drugs that were FDA approved but manufactured for sale outside of the United States in countries like Ireland, Israel, Canada, that those drugs could be, with their foreign labeling, brought back into the United States under a separate pricing regime, thus avoiding some of the rebates that, as we have all talked, have become problematic in artificially raising prices and then giving special deals to PBMs, to our MA formulary, for example. And so this was a way to get around some of that rebate game playing, but it was authorized in rule, believe September of 2020. And so this would be to just give an advantage to those drugs. And it does impact financially our preferred drug list. And so there is a cost on the spreadsheet for this.
Okay. And Senator, one of the things that a question that's kind of come up around this is, what incentive the manufacturers would have to bring a drug that they're selling overseas and bring it into the United States? Are these drugs that are not already being sold here or not being sold by the same companies? Or, you know, why would they do this?
because that way they can get to a market with a more transparent price. So they are drugs that are sold and approved in the United States, but they're packaged slightly differently, and they would be able to sell them direct to consumer without the rebate price. You and I had significant conversations about insulin, for example, and part of the interactivity of rebates and what happens if you net out those rebates. So a manufacturer could bring in drugs without having to follow some of the federally imposed rebates. You and I discussed in the Affordable Care Act, there was, I believe, a 23% mandatory rebate for the federal government. Well, that does impact prices in the rest of the market. And some of the rebates are obviously far beyond a 23% rebate, but this would let them get around that and make it easier for consumers to get those prices.
Senator, is anybody else doing this? Any other states doing this?
Not yet. Sometimes you have to be the first, but I've been watching this for a long time. And once I understood that foreign drug prices weren't impacted by rebates the way United States drug prices were, it piqued my interest. And then as rulemaking promulgated through the previous administration, started working on it more heavily.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Are there any other questions from members about this? Or any comments? Okay. Everybody's tired today or something. End of a long week. Okay. Or maybe these just aren't people's particular issues of interest. Anyway, House Section 7 is House only. This is a Bierman bill. And this one is supported by quite a number of consumer groups who are interested in chronic diseases. So as you all know, people with certain chronic diseases need to take very expensive drugs. And the idea here is that it creates quite a burden for consumers when they when they're buying insurance. I think this is individual market mainly or exclusively, and they understand they have to pay out of pockets, but because of the that they have these high priced, they have to meet their deductible before they get any help with their drugs. And so what this is trying to do is get some plans into the market where a person could choose a plan where their out-of-pocket cost is spread out over the year so that the consumer, it really doesn't change the consumer's out-of-pocket total cost. What it does is allow them to have more of a money management strategy when they're paying for their drugs. So that is, you know, to me, honestly, this seems like a pretty modest proposal. I haven't personally gotten any feedback from plans about this. I don't know if they have objection to it. But honestly, I almost would say, why don't we do this for all plans? Why only 25% of them? It just seems like a no-brainer. But anyway, this is strongly supported by a lot of groups that represent consumers with chronic diseases. Senator Benson. Oh, and you are muted.
There we go. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm really interested in this idea, but I have not done research on this, nor have I heard feedback. Concerns, I think, from the plans would be a fair expression. But are there other states doing this? What impact has it had on rates, for example? I like the idea that a consumer can manage a little better over time. If you have a big healthcare expense in January, for example, not just prescription drugs, but other unforeseen medical expenses, and how does this allow you to sort of finance that over the year? It does shift the cash flow burden to
the insurance provider. And so I think I don't understand the full risk that's here, but I understand why this would be very attractive to consumers.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. I think we probably need to do just a bit more exploration of this and maybe have some further conversation about it. I just would say that, my gosh, I don't think that the cash flow issue is quite the same for the health plans as it is for the consumer. In fact, right now, my understanding is the health plans are doing extremely well, but there may be other issues here, including, I'm trying to come up with the word, shifting of, risk, who buys the plan, who buys the different plans. The word is escaping me, but there are different market issues here that may come into play as well. Senator Utke.
Just a quick comment that I would, it appears that health plans haven't weighed in on this, and I can't imagine a circumstance where this wouldn't drive up the cost of those policies and premiums just because it create more work and they're playing banker. So I think we definitely need to know what those numbers are first.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Any other comments on this? Okay, I think we could move on to maybe have a bit of discussion. The next provisions, the House Sections 8 and 20, are Representative Elkins. And I think it would probably be very helpful to have him to discuss some of this. But this has been a longstanding issue that consumers, some consumers will choose their plan based on the formulary because they know they need a very expensive drug and they want to make sure that drug is available. And then sometimes what you get is that the health plan changes the formulary, the PBM changes the formulary in the middle of the plan year. And the consumer is locked into the plan, but the health plan and their PBM are not. And it really creates a great deal of unfairness for consumers. And that is also a big concern of the Minnesota Medical Association when you get somebody who's on a particular drug and then suddenly it's not covered anymore under their insurance or it's covered at a higher price. So that is, there's a lot more to talk about in this section, but this is something that the House has worked on quite a bit because it seems to be quite a problem for consumers. Senator Benson.
There you go. Thank you, Madam Chair. And on this, I understand the attractiveness of a frozen formulary. I think in my preview of the language, there was some allowance for moving to a drug that was a lower cost to the consumer. So I understand they've tried to work on flexibility because part of formulary management is to reduce the cost of acquiring drugs. Do you recall how often is this formulary allowed to change?
I'm not certain about that. Mr. Chun, do you remember what, do you know offhand?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Benson. The language, I think, defines the term or the enrollee contract term as a year for the private sector plans and then a calendar quarter for the DHS healthcare programs.
And I guess, Madam Chair, why would it be a year for the private sector but calendar quarter for DHS?
Well, Senator, the reason is that DHS, as you know, has a lot of federal rules that it has to meet. And it's really, oh, good, there's Representative Elkins. So it's really, I think, a matter of what they're allowed to do and what they have to do in order to manage the formulary. I think someone from DHS would be here that could explain that much better than I could. And Mr. Hope might be here. And I think we should ask him that question because I think it's an important one for us all to understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But why does DHS have a frozen formulary at all?
Mr. Hope, welcome. Maybe you could address those questions for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chad Hope, Deputy Director of Purchasing Service Delivery at DHS. So there's a couple of nuances to the difference in the medical assistance formulary and a commercial formulary. The first being that we don't really have a formulary. Every rebate eligible drug is part of our pharmacy benefit. There's not a lockdown formulary. So it's very different than a commercial plan. And the difference between a calendar year and a calendar quarter is due to the fact that the federal Medicaid drug rebates change quarterly based on either price increases or reporting from the manufacturers. And a lot of times those rebates don't change very significantly from quarter to quarter, but there are instances where the rebates can change very significantly. And without the flexibility to be able to adjust to those federal changes, the state would be in a position of either incurring potentially tremendous costs or foregoing the opportunity to have cost savings.
So, Madam Chair, if I could ask Mr. Hope a clarifying question. So the federal government doesn't require you to change every quarter or prohibit you from changing less frequently, but you do it because new rebates become available and there would be a fiscal impact if you were compelled to only change once a year.
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. There's not a federal prohibition against not changing your preferred drug list for a year.
So, Madam Chair, then my question would be, if rebates are changing that frequently and DHS has the flexibility to optimize rebates, why are we prohibiting the private market from optimizing rebates? Because we just had it demonstrated that it would cost money to require DHS. There's nothing federally that says they have to change every quarter. So we could put it at a year, just like the private market. But Mr. Hope just explained to us that that would limit their ability to optimize rebates and cost the state money.
Well, one thing I would say, Senator, and I'm going to let Representative Elkins weigh in on this too, since he's very, very interested in this. But I would say to you that when a person is on our public programs, they're not buying a public program in order to get a certain drug. And when we have consumers who are buying private plans, that it often is exactly what's going on. The consumer is shopping for a plan and picking one based on what it covers. And then that coverage gets jerked away from that consumer. That's a kind of a bait and switch thing. Maybe not intentionally a bait and switch, but it has the effect of that. And that's not the same in our public programs. So, you know, recognizing that there could be a cost to this, it gives this it's a very different. When a person goes on a public program, they're not buying a formulary. They're taking what is provided. And as Mr. Hope explained, you know, they're covering a very wide variety of drugs. So I think that does create a difference there. And so I know before I go to Representative Elkins, I know Senator Abler had his hand up and I don't know if his comment was to this topic, but let me check in with him and welcome Senator Abler. Glad you were able to join us this morning. I see you're in uniform. Thanks.
Oh yeah, I'll put my mask on. I appreciate the comment, the whole topic here, and I've been trying to follow best I can. And to this whole point, I just wanted to put in a plug just for trying to figure something out here. And Representative Liebling, you kind of said it just as well, but I wanted to just echo it a little bit and even expand to the idea that, you know, maybe some of the people choosing health partners over Blue Cross might like their formulary better too. And so there really needs to be some continuity when people become so dependent on certain products. And I just wanted to, and so on the private side, I don't know if there's an intentionality. We hate to question motives, but there is an effect. And I hope at the end, I mean, conference committee is a time for this sort of thing. And I think Senator Benson's concerns are legitimate, but I think that the intention of this section is also very legitimate. So perhaps there can be kind of a meeting of the minds and protect to the extent we can in consumers that make a choice that they think they get to actually keep. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for that, Senator Abler. And I agree that, you know, I hope we can work some things out, because this issue of drugs and availability and prices is massive. And obviously we can't solve it all here. It's way too complicated. There's so much that goes on over our heads as a state, but hopefully we can make some improvements. Senator Benson, is it okay if I go to Representative Elkins, or did you want to have a quick follow-up before I do that?
Is he testifying?
Well, he's not testifying, but this is his bill, and I think he's just helping me out with explaining what he's trying to do here, and he's kind of our resident expert on it. It's not so really then, formal testimony, I don't
then
think.
Then he would be a testifier. He's not on the conference committee.
Okay.
But
we don't usually think of members as testifiers, but I guess in this context,
sure. They would be. Yep. Can you? I need some understanding why CGIP is excluded, and does CGIP have the same formulary, the broad formulary, that our preferred drug list has? Because if it doesn't work for CGIP, and it doesn't really work for the PDL, we're just basically saying to the private market, we're going to give government special treatment, because they're a little more special than everybody else. And the private market's just gonna have to deal with it, regardless of cost. So why isn't CGIP included?
Well, Senator, what I would say is, first of all, CGIP, kind of like public programs, you don't choose your formulary. Everybody on CGIP gets the same formulary. So this element of the consumer choosing and then not getting the benefit of their bargain is not present there. So I think that that makes a difference. And yes, we all have the same formulary. I personally am not in CGIP, but everyone in CGIP has the same formulary. So yes, that is the case. And so I would not say that the public entities are getting special treatment. I would say what we're trying to do here is give consumers who are buying a plan special treatment. The special treatment being that they get the benefit of the thing they think they're buying. That when a company says to them, you know, come and sign up with us because we have X, Y, and Z to offer you, that they get that for the next year. That's what we're trying to do here. So
and Madam Chair, but does CGIP change their formulary?
Well, Madam Senator Benson, I assume that they do, but the fact is that you don't get a choice. You're not buying CGIP one plan or another. So, you know, it's not entirely different, I grant you that, but I think there is a real difference that you're not luring somebody in and saying, here's what you're going to get, and then you don't get it, because you're going to be in CGIP. You're either in CGIP or you're not in CGIP. You're not choosing a formulary in CGIP.
Madam Chair, for example, you're not on CGIP because you have access to other coverage. But what if somebody had two adults in the house, both had access to employer-sponsored coverage, but they opted to put the family in CGIP because the drug their child needed was on the CGIP formulary, and then CGIP changed it? And they could have chosen another employer plan. If they had known, if they'd known the change was coming. And so if we're not going to include CGIP and we're not going to include the PDL, that strikes me as canary in the coal mine. There's a problem here that we can't just gloss over.
So I'm going to go to Representative Elkins. And Representative Elkins, welcome to the conference committee. And if you want to just make a brief comment of explanation about your bill here, anything that you think we haven't covered that's important for us to know. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, both of you. I think I can address the questions that Senator Benson has raised. First of all, in terms of the big difference between our Medicaid plans and the commercial plans, is that you know, prior to the to setting their plan offerings for the following plan year, the health plans through their PBMs negotiate with the manufacturers to set the prices that they're going to pay the manufacturers for the next plan year. That's pretty much set by the end of the summer. Typically, the plans will file adjustments to their formularies with Commerce late in the summer so that they're pinned down in before the plans actually make their offerings to the public during during open enrollment. But their contracts with the manufacturers almost universally include price protection for the following year. In other words, all of the big PBMs that do the pharmacy management on behalf of the plans have frozen their prices for the following plan year in their contracts with the manufacturers. So each of the PBMs, and there are three of them physically located in my district, have told me that that's the case. And in the Milliman report that you've seen from the PCMA, their trade association, that report confirms that that practice is almost universal. So our plans and their PBMs in the commercial market don't have to worry about the manufacturers raising their prices during the course of the plan year because they've protected themselves against that contractually. In terms of what the bill requires, the bill is being mischaracterized as a frozen formulary bill. It doesn't freeze the formularies. The plans can make any changes they want to their formularies on 60 days notice. The only real restriction in the bill is that if a member has chosen a plan during an open enrollment based on the presentation, the representations that the plan has made in their plan documents, and they see that a drug that they're taking because of some chronic condition is on that formulary, the bill does say that you can't kick a person off a drug that they are taking that their doctor has prescribed for them because of a formulary change. That's the only meaningful restriction other than the advance notice requirements that this bill imposes on the PBMs and the plans with respect to the formulary. So the only thing that the plans and the PBMs are losing is some bargaining leverage with the manufacturers in cases where a new cheaper drug is introduced during the course of the plan year. But of course, the plans and the PBMs can incentivize a person who's taking a more expensive drug to move to the less expensive drug by putting the new drug on a more favorable tier in their formulary at a lower price. And in fact, the PCMA's own study shows that they anticipate about half of consumers would actually do that. And so if you read the Milliman report, it's a very good report. It estimates that even with a hard formulary freeze, which this bill is not, the total impact on premiums in the commercial market would be, you know, somewhere around 0.4% to a little over 1% at most. So with respect to CGIP, I would observe that, first of all, it's likely that we're going to pass the CGIP reverse auction bill. It has bipartisan support in both chambers. That one is coming through state government. And if we do that, then the whole CGIP fiscal note related to this bill is completely moot anyway. Second, I've spoken with the representatives of MAPE and ASPE, whose members are the largest bulk of the members of CGIP, and they say, you know, this is something that we want. We're going into contract openers for the 2003 plan year, which is when this would take effect. Their current contract with CVS Caremark, which is the current PBM for the CGIP plan, expires at the end of the 2022 plan year. So they've told me that, look, we'll just negotiate that benefit. We think it's valuable. We'll negotiate it into our next contract. And if we move to the reverse auction, CGIP will be able to specify that benefit must be included in the plan. And so it will be included on what the PBMs are bidding for the 2003 plan year.
And all right, so, Senator Benson.
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Elkins. So if the reverse auction passes,
yep,
it applies to CGIP.
Yep.
It will save money in other ways. If the modified frozen formulary is in place in the private market and they wanted to use a reverse auction tool, your language would make the private market reverse auction ineffectual.
Representative Elkins?
Following you there, I'm sorry.
Senator, are you saying if in the private market, if the private market used a reverse auction to hire a PBM? Is that what you
do? Do private plans contract? Yes.
A plan could use a reverse auction to choose their PBM, and they could specify in the specification for that plan that a provision like this be included. And based on the Milliman report, you would expect that the impact on the price, the bids that they would receive would be less than 0.5%.
And so we could put this language, Madam Chair, my apologies. We could put this language on CGIP and they could just deal with it, just like this language going on for the private market. They could just deal with it. And with regard to the reverse auction, I think it's a great idea. New Hampshire has actually added language that said that's permissive so that their individual market can use a reverse auction to acquire PBM. Minnesota doesn't explicitly prohibit it. And so they are, our insurance companies could use this. Obviously any ERISA plan could use this product. So I believe it's going to be successful in helping with cost savings in CGIP. And I would hate to do anything that got in the way of it being used to improve cost management of healthcare in other parts of the coverage market.
Yeah, so what I would say—
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, is that really there isn't anything in that I know of in current state law that would prevent a health plan in Minnesota from using a reverse auction to select their PBM. And including a provision like this, especially if it's required by state law in the specification that they would, when they put it out for bid. You know, we're kind of in a pickle here because we have, you know, bills proceeding side by side. And so when the fiscal note for the CGIP provision on House File 58, the underlying bill for this was done, MMB and the Legislative Budget Office made an assumption that the current contract with CVS Caremark would be continued into the 2023 plan year, even though their contract with CVS Caremark expires at the end of the 2022 plan year. So it's kind of a catch-22. You know, how do we deal with this? And basically what the fiscal note said is that under CVS Caremark's standard plan, which CGIP has currently bought into, CGIP would lose half of its rebates if it changed the contract by imposing this kind of a requirement. But the contract is open for 2023, so this requirement doesn't exist in any current contract. So the assumption, and we'll be talking about this in the LBO Oversight Committee this summer if it ever meets. I'm a member of that committee as well. We'll be talking about the abuse of the fiscal note process that CGIP allowed its current PBM to abuse the process, basically.
Madam Chair, if I could,
Senator Benson,
Representative Elkins' point, and CGIP assumed that they would do as well in the new CVS Caremark contract negotiation as a reverse auction would. So reverse auction gets zero fiscal benefit, even though every other state that's tried it has had fiscal benefit. So they're playing it both ways. They're assuming, you know, that CVS is going forward and they're going to do an exemplary job of negotiating. But the fact of the matter is the frozen formulary would limit their ability to negotiate with CVS Caremark because it would go into law before they were allowed to complete contract negotiations. They're just entering that negotiation period now. So this would become law. And regardless of who they negotiated with, whether it's CVS Caremark or another, this would tie their hands as to how frequently they could enact rebates, which is why CGIP is exempted from the fiscal cost in this bill.
Yeah, but again—
Representative Elkins.
The PBMs negotiate with the manufacturers on an annual basis and lock in their prices in the July, August timeframe for the following year. And you know, if this became law and it applied to CGIP, then the standard plan upon which, for example, the current CVS Caremark deal with CGIP is based, the standard plan for CVS Caremark in Minnesota would have to include this provision.
Right.
Yeah.
And it would be frozen, and they said it would cost money.
And it's not frozen. They can change the plan, the formulary, whenever they want throughout the year on 60 days notice. They just can't kick a person who has been prescribed a particular drug that's working for them and was on the formulary at the time that the person enrolled in the plan was there. So it's actually a relatively, the people who are being protected by this are people who are taking a drug, have been taking a drug for a period of time that's expensive and deals with a chronic condition.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
To this provision, it doesn't work for DHS because it adds cost. It doesn't work for CGIP because it adds cost. It interferes with the ability of either the preferred drug list or CGIP or the private market to use a reverse auction process, which is focused on bringing down the cost of prescription drugs as part of the coverage mix. So there are significant issues, and I've given you three very specific examples as to why this interferes with cost savings in the market. So I, as always, am willing to engage with you, Madam Chair, and the proponents of this language, but right now the Senate is opposed.
So, Senator, I think what I heard from Representative Elkins, and granted, this is there's a lot to unpack here, and appreciate Representative Elkins helping us out. Obviously, he's got depth that I certainly don't have on this issue. But what I drew from what he said is that we actually could include CGIP, the fiscal note notwithstanding, and that if we're using the reverse auction, which it looks like we may do, it sounds more to me like perhaps a timing issue of when different pieces go into effect. And anyway, I hope we can, I understand that you're not there, Senator Benson. I totally understand that, but you know, perhaps we can continue to talk about this offline, because this is a provision that has significant support from the medical community. And I think it is something that, as Senator Abler expressed, for consumers, it's a big deal. If this hits you, it's a really big deal. And it's not a frozen formula as Representative Elkins was describing. It's actually a much more modest change. And if we could figure out a way to make this work, and I don't know if there's a, I think we'd probably need more discussion on the public program side. I think that's a really different issue. But certainly with CGIP, I mean, this is something that if we could make it work for CGIP enrollees, it would be a great benefit for them as well. So anyway, I think we can probably move on from this and go on to the next topic. Let's see, how are we doing for time? Well, we've got, I'm glad that we do have time on the calendar for these discussions, because I think they're very important. So the next piece that we have here, going down the list, is House Sections 9, 11, 12, 21, and those have to do with biologics, biosimilars. And that is Representative Schultz's bill. And I wonder if she would like to say anything about that bill, and if members have questions or want to have any discussion on that. Representative Schultz, are you?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you, Chair Liebling. So the goal of this language, this bill, is to reduce the price of very expensive biologics with competition between biologics and biosimilar products. So you can think of it as brand name and generic. biologics are very expensive. People with inflammatory arthritis, for example, take these injectables, which are thousands of dollars for each injection. And what this provision does is that it doesn't allow health plan carriers or PBMs to have preferential treatment for biologics, the more expensive drug, if there are biosimilars on the market. And there's a bipartisan support for this bill. Senator Nelson is carrying it and I think has a standalone bill. I'm not sure if her language is in the Senate omnibus bill, but we're working on an amendment with all the various stakeholders and that's almost finished. So I will bring that to conference committee and I'm hoping there'll be bipartisan support, but maybe Chair Benson can comment on that.
Senator Benson.
And Representative Schultz, thank you. That's a good representation. There was amendment language brought forward just before we moved this bill off the floor. But as we started hearing from some people who hadn't been initially at the table, realized there was maybe more to be worked out. And so we did leave this provision out, not because there's fundamental objection, but we weren't ready to settle into a position. And so I appreciate you and Senator Nelson working with that next tier of stakeholders. I would look forward to finding something well resolved to put in this place.
Great. Well, thank you. It's great to know. I didn't know that was moving forward, but I'm really glad to hear that it is, because once again, you know, these are really important issues for consumers. Okay, then we have the identical provision coming up next, which we don't need to discuss. I think everybody's kind of realizes that PBMs have been kind of not always so fair to the pharmacies that they are dealing with. And this is some attempt to straighten some of that out with prohibiting the gag rules. Then we have the Senate only sections 4 to 6, the one that I had asked the question about whether it has, this is the medical gas issue, the medical gas fee issue. And this is a Senate only provision. The members who had worked on this are not on this conference committee, on the House side members, I should say. And but I see that Senator Curran has his hand up. Senator, did you want to discuss this provision?
Sure. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so the medical gas provision that you'll see in the Senate is to remove medical gas providers. They were caught up in this, in the opioid fee creation. And what this does is it removes or changes the definition that removes the medical gas manufacturers and wholesalers creates a more refined definition. It also reduces the fee structure from the $5,260 to the to $260. And there was a revenue impact on it, which is about, I think, between the forecast between $230,000 to $240,000 of the revenue impact from the which would have been removed from the Opioid Advisory Task Force, the pool of dollars assigned to that. That initiative. With the McKinsey settlement, our proposal moves that revenue be backfilled for the portion that backfills the medical gas piece of it. And then it removes it, again, it clearly removes the medical gas from being included at provision. It's one of those corrective measures that I think we have to go through on a routine basis to when we have undue harm placed on a particular business. But we also need it in place to preserve small medical gas providers throughout the state, because they will just stop providing medical gas. Seems in many cases, it's just a small portion of their business. And they could be a very large gas provider, but medical could be a small portion. And this makes sure we have that vital availability all throughout the state. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Senator Curran. I don't know if, I know that, Representative Liz Olson was primarily working on this, I think, on the House side, and I don't think we probably have her here today. So we might just have to leave it at that. And but I think from what little I understand about this issue or know about this issue, I think the House has a significantly different position on it. And that's why it was not included in the House side. But we'll need to come back to that. Okay, let's see. Senate Section 7.
Madam Chair, if I could—
Senator Benson.
If I could suggest for process purposes that we take the opioid articles, send them to Representative Olson and see can, because I didn't realize that this concern to the House. And I really hope we can get something going forward so that we don't lose medical gas providers in the state.
Yeah, well, okay. We will try to find a way to have more of that discussion. No, I have to say though, without being deep in the weeds on this particular issue, oftentimes when people don't want to pay something or they don't like something, they say, this will drive us out of business. I guess I maintain always a little bit of skepticism about that, although I hear Senator Curran saying that for some of them, this is a sideline, this isn't their main business, and that I guess you're saying they may drop this line of business, not go out of business over a $5,000 fee. But anyway, I will engage with Representative Olson on this and try to get her to, so that we can have some House Senate conversation on this one. Senator Curran?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just some clarity. You are right. The going out of business or dropping the line of business in many of these and large gas providers throughout rural Minnesota, medical gas is a small portion. In some cases, we heard testimony from those that have $10,000 is their from a line of business is medical gas. And so a $5,000 fee consumes half of all the revenue from it, and they will drop that service. The other part goes back to really the intent of the law based on opioid manufacturing. And so to include them originally, I believe was the original mistake. And I agree with you, the arguments are very creative when people want to remove a level of taxation. But in this particular case, I'd be hard pressed to find a definition that fits that they're a contributing factor to the opioid addiction and abuse and production of opioids. So I think on the definition of why they got included, I'm not sure how that got through. But when you look at it today, the definition captured them inadvertently, and we need to. And luckily, with the McKinsey settlement, there is some revenue to backfill that particular vital element to the Opioid Advisory Task Force, furthering our goal. So I think I don't think it's the case where somebody just doesn't want to be taxed. It doesn't fit the original intent of the creation of the opioid tax or the fee that we assess the opioid manufacturers. And in this case, we can remove the harm and provide and preserve a vital resource throughout the state. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator. I do remember some time ago having a discussion with Representative Olson about this. And I hope I'm not misstating what she said, but I think that the point was that she did not feel that this was a mistake and that they knew what they were doing in the conference committee when they imposed this fee, which of course does not mean that everything is great and we should never change it. That's not what I'm saying, but I think that she would push back on the idea that this was somehow inadvertent. But anyway, we will try to structure some further conversation on this so that we can make the best decision for everybody in our bill here. Thank you, Senator. So let's see. The next is a Senate-only provision, and that is Section 7, exempts opiates used for medication-assisted therapy for substance use disorder from being calculated as opiate units when determining whether an opiate manufacturer is subject to the annual opiate registration fee. Senator Coran, is this also something that you could speak to?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Maybe Senator Benson can cover that. What particular section?
I have to apologize,
Madam Chair. We just ended State Gov Conference Committee and we had to do both. So.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Curran has been pulling double duty. Madam Chair, Senator Curran, Senate Section 7. So substance use disorder treatment drugs. I believe this would be Suboxone primarily. That's used to help people resolve their opioid addiction are currently counted. And I don't think, again, that was the intent of the law to count towards a licensing fee, something that actually helps people end their opioid addiction. And so again, we took the opportunity of the previously unanticipated McKinsey money to offset and make some of these things right. And I do believe it's a public good to have substance use disorder treatments available in the state of Minnesota without fee or penalty. And so that's the origin of this provision.
Okay, so that sounds like something that we probably also should engage with Representative Olson on. I mean, this is all kind of goes back to 2 years ago when we had that separate opioid conference committee, and that's where some of these provisions came from, right? And those people were separate from those working with us on the HHS bill. So that would be is that one that Senator Coran is able to work with her on as well, or would that mean be another member that we'd need to engage for that conversation?
Madam Chair, Senator Coran is capable of handling pretty much any of the items in our bill that he would want to take on. Opioids, he has spent a good amount of time helping with this year.
Great, thank you. Okay, good, great to know. And so we'll get that going in some way. So the next one here is House only, and that is sections 15 and 22. This was a bill from Representative Akam, and she has a concern about when, now that so many people get their drugs through mail order, sometimes your pharmaceuticals that you get through mail order have to remain at a certain temperature in order to be effective. And she had a concern that when the drugs get to your door, and sometimes these are very expensive drugs, that the consumer has no real way of knowing whether the proper temperature has been maintained in transit. And we all learned through with the COVID vaccines, the ones especially that had to be kept at super cold temperatures, that there were devices in with the boxes that guaranteed that the proper temperature was maintained. And I think this is where she might have gotten the idea that these are, and did some research and found that these are pretty inexpensive little devices. And that when a consumer is paying a lot of money for a drug, that they might need some assurance that the drug has been maintained at the right temperature throughout its journey to the person's door. So she had a bill, and we had heard that. And then also Dr. Weiberg got involved, the Board of Pharmacy got involved and worked on this final language with her. And I wonder if Dr. Weiberg, is this something that you could speak to a little bit just to fill in some gaps that I might not have covered here so that we can understand where the board is on this provision?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, this is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. The bill did originate with Representative Akam. She did ask me for technical assistance. It's not a board bill. The board does support this particular version of the bill. The first version of the bill actually would have required the specialty and mail order pharmacies to put one of those devices in the packaging during shipment. The representatives of some of the mail order and specialty pharmacies had concerns about that, Told me, and probably Representative Acom, that they thought that the cheaper devices had false negatives and false positives. I wasn't able in my research to confirm that. The companies that make these devices say that they are accurate. So what the current version of the bill does is, and I would be surprised if they would object to it at this point, because there are two things. One is that it simply requires them to develop appropriate policies and procedures based on United States Pharmacopeia standards and on standards by private sector accreditation standards for shipping, which they say they're already following. And so it requires them to have those policies in place, which they tell me they already have in place. One difference would be that they would need to provide them to the board upon request, which we would probably do if we received a complaint from a consumer about receiving a drug that was frozen or above normal room temperature. The other thing, I don't think it's in this section, but it's related, section 22 maybe, is it does require the Board of Pharmacy to do a study of those devices and report back to the legislature to sort of answer that question about whether or not using those devices would be cost effective.
All right, thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Any questions or comments on that from members?
Senator. Madam Chair and Dr. Weiberg, remind me again, how much do each of these devices cost?
Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the cheaper ones are probably only a dollar or two a piece, which actually, of course, if you're doing many millions of packages, could add up to some money. Those are the ones that I think the representatives of the mail order and specialty pharmacies say aren't particularly accurate. The ones that are more accurate are quite a bit more expensive and probably would be cost prohibitive.
Okay, Senator Benson. So, Madam Chair and Dr. Weiberg, does the language, and I am sorry, I'm trying to get up to speed on this. Does the language require it only for prescriptions that are temperature sensitive, or is it for all mail order prescriptions?
Dr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I believe it is all, not just for those that are temperature sensitive, although actually what I think the language says right now, wait, I should back up a minute. The current language doesn't require the use of the monitors at all. It simply requires them to have appropriate policies and procedures in place that are in line with United States Pharmacopeia standards, the recommendation of the manufacturers, and the recommendations made by accreditation associations. So the current language actually doesn't require the use of the monitors at all. That's the second piece, which requires the board to study whether or not those monitors are cost effective. That's why I think at this point, I haven't talked to them recently. I don't think they'd object to this language because it doesn't require them to use the monitors. It just requires them to have policies and procedures in place that they've told me they already have in place. The one difference, as I mentioned, is the board would be able to ask for those policies and procedures, for example, if we got a complaint, so that we could see that they were actually following policies and procedures consistent with the USP.
Senator? Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see Mr. Hope is still on. If he is available and listening, I have a question if pharmacies would be reimbursed for using these items, because right now there's a survey that's gone out, a price set. And I'm wondering if pharmacies start adding these, will their reimbursement change?
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair, this is Chad Hope with DHS. The cost of delivering the prescription to the member is paid through the dispensing fee. There's not an additional add-on if part of the policy and procedure of the pharmacy is to put additional tracking into the package. Now, in subsequent surveys of providers' cost, if that is a practice that they adopt, it would be reflected in future survey results.
Madam Chair.
Center. And
thank you, Mr. Hope. So if we in any way mandate these, we would then have to project the cost because it would raise the cost of the dispensing fee.
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't know what we would estimate for that because as Dr. Weiberg was saying, I have no way of knowing which packages they would put additional tracking in and which ones would just be part of policies and procedures. It would be one where we would need to measure the results and then any proposal that was put forward for public programs in the future would be reflective of the cost at that point.
Madam Chair, in particular, specialty pharmacy that needs to be kept appropriately chilled or at in a temperature range, they're incorporated into the current survey, but if we mandated a monitoring device, that would inherently increase the cost. And so future surveys then would reflect a higher mean survey price point. And if we differentiate between non-specialty and specialty pharmacy in those surveys, we might see a spike. I just want us to be aware that if we just expect the industry to be professional, it might actually work out instead of us mandating inserting temperature devices, which were in the original language. So just pointing out that this is a good practice for the industry, for them to meet the needs of their customers, but us mandating that particularly an accurate device be inserted into specialty pharmacy, much less all pharmacy, will show up in our public program survey of dispensing fees.
Well, Senator, thanks for that. I mean, as Dr. Weiberg pointed out, that's not the language before us. We're kind of in the exploration phase here. But also I would have a question for probably for Dr. Weiberg about this. So what happens now when kind of, you know, who kind of bears the burden of if you're ordering a specialty drug and it comes to you in the mail and say it has been, you know, it's summertime and it's gotten overheated. What would happen right now? I mean, I assume that the consumer would have no way of knowing that, right? And so wouldn't that kind of be, the consumer would sort of bear the burden of that. Am I right about that? Or how would that actually work under, you know, presently?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the way that would work presently is, in some cases, I think consumers would know if a medication like insulin is supposed to be kept cold and it's, you know, environmental temperature because it's been out on somebody's front doorstep in the middle of the summer, they know. In some cases, it might be a little bit more subtle. Most of the medications we're talking about are going to be medications that need to be kept at room temperature or below. But I do think that most of the specialty pharmacies and the mail order pharmacies do have procedures in place to replace the medication. The problem with that, though, is depending on how much supply that the patient has at home, they might not be in a position to have to wait for getting a new shipment. So yeah, there are some potential burdens to consumers. I can tell you that we get not a whole lot of complaints compared to other complaints. We probably get about a dozen complaints a year about these sorts of issues. We do recommend that because complaint process takes a while to investigate, we do recommend that consumers go immediately to the pharmacy provider if they haven't already done so to see how they can, you know, maybe overnight the drug to them or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there is potentially some burden on the consumer. Ironically, though, there's some potentially burden on the mail order pharmacy because some of these specialty drugs cost tens of thousands of dollars. And if they have to replace it, that's going to be a cost on them. I think that for some of those more expensive drugs, the pharmacies may already be inserting temperature monitoring devices. but not necessarily for the less expensive drugs that can still be critical drugs. But
right,
but,
and
yeah, I was just gonna say, but again, you know, at this point, that would be the sort of issue that the board would look at in this study. And I've only done a little bit of research on this for providing technical assistance to Representative Acom, but it could be that if what the mail order pharmacies are telling me is true, and they would need to use $50 a piece units to really guarantee accuracy, maybe this would turn out to be not cost effective. I don't know. We'd have to do the study.
And Dr. Weiberg, you know, if you've got a $10,000 drug and it lands on somebody's doorstep at the wrong temperature and the consumer is like, hey, I'm not sure this is going to work for me because it's not been kept at the right temperature, is there ever a proof issue? Or, I mean, what if the consumer goes back to the pharmacy and says, hey, this drug was too warm, and does the pharmacy always say, okay, then? We'll accept that. It's our fault. We'll replace it. I mean, you know, the fact that it could be a very expensive drug, I'm just wondering, does that fall on the consumer? Because that would be my concern. I mean, it's bad enough for the pharmacy or for the manufacturer, but for the consumer, it could be just absolutely a disaster.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can't guarantee that all specialty and mail order pharmacies in all cases replace drugs like this. I do think they have policies in place to do that. Whether they do that 100% of the time when they get a request from a patient or not, I can't say that.
Okay, so, all right, well, thank you so much, Dr. Weiberg. So, I mean, this is something that we, you know, given that I certainly understand if we were mandating this right now that there would be heartburn over this. And I think, Senator, your concerns are well taken, Senator Benson, but that's not what this is doing. It's just studying it. And given the expense of drugs that are, you know, these, how expensive these drugs can be, and that I assume that a lot of them are biologics and drugs that are temperature sensitive, I think this is something that would be very much worth looking into, just as a consumer protection matter, which is the way that Representative Acom brought it up. And whatever the recommendations are, I think we can deal with them at that time. But from my point of view, to not find out would be not that responsible, because it is an issue. And it may be that what we find out is do nothing is the thing we need to do, and that, you know, but I think it would behoove us to go forward with this language, and I hope the Senate will give that some thought. So moving on here, we have the next one is identical sections, which is the drug repository program changes. And I don't think we need to spend much time on that unless anybody wants to. Okay, then we have another, some sections that are different in the House and Senate having to do with the opiate epidemic response fund. For the House, it's Article 12, Section 19. For the Senate, it's Section 12, Senate Article 4, Section 12. And again, I'm not in the weeds on this. I don't know if we have for the House anybody here who is, but I don't know, did the Senate want to talk about this at all, or should we kind of pass on this piece until we have and move this off to the opiate discussions? Senator?
Madam Chair, I think this can be included in the opiate discussions. This provision of our opioid language was just about alignment, and so I'd ask, and not at this point, but for our fiscal staff to give us advice on when the information arrives and when the grants are issued with respect to legislative engagement. Because I think that the challenge was sometimes the grants were actually being made or recommended before we knew the full dollar amount. And so I do need technical clarity on this before we make a final decision. I don't want to say parking lot it, but Senator Abler has raised his hand, Madam Chair.
All right, Senator Abler.
Well, thanks, just briefly. We added some money into the fund, I think $3 million a year. I don't have any documents in front of me, but just, you know, because we heard that it was falling short. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I have some memory of that issue as well. So, well, this is great. We can put that in not the parking lot, but the other track, maybe the moving other track. Not parking at all, right? So, okay. Next item, Senate Article 1, Section 11, that the House does not have this, and it looks like something similar that would go in that bucket as well with the opioid folks.
Agreed.
Okay. And then we have the next one, which is Senate Section 13 about the injectable opiates and being counted when determining about the opiate fee. So similar deal there.
Yes.
It looks like. Okay. And that brings us to the end of the prescription drug article. So very good. So the other piece for today is the House Article 7 and Senate Article 8, which is telehealth. And let's see, who was going to walk us through this? Ms. Kavanaugh?
Madam Chair and members, yes, this is it's been assigned to me. So to begin with, it's House Article 7 and Senate Article 8. I think in the big broad picture, there really isn't any really major differences in how both the House and the Senate deal with telehealth. The differences, or the major differences, are how they get there and how long they stay there. So having said that, I can start going through the list of sections. House Section 1 and Senate Section 1, these establish requirements for the coverage of services delivered through telehealth in the private regulated health plan, the commercial market. And there are several minor differences. And I should say that another difference between the House and the Senate are the effective dates. The House, all of their sections are the effective dates January 1, 2022, or upon federal approval. The Senate effective dates are all July 1, 2021. House Section 2 and Senate Section 2, these make conforming changes to the telehealth section in the physician licensure statute. These are these sections are identical, except again for the effective date. House Section 3 and Senate Section 3, these sections permit the required examination before a prescriber can prescribe a medication-assisted therapy for a substance use disorder drug to be conducted through telehealth. These sections are identical. Senate Sections 4 through 6 and House Sections 4 through 6 and Senate Sections 4 through 6. These make changes in Chapter 245G that permit services and assessments for substance use disorder to be delivered by telehealth. And this describes when telehealth can be used for certain services and assessments. There are minor differences in these sections. House Section 7 and Senate Section 7, these sections clarify that chemical use assessments may be conducted through telehealth. Again, these sections are identical, except for the effective date. House Section 8, Senate Section 8, these sections clarify that chemical dependency services may be provided through telehealth. Identical sections, except for the effective date. House Section 9 and Senate Section 9, these are just simply conforming changes. These sections are identical. Senate Section 10 is a Senate only section, and this permits a psychiatric provider as part of an ACT team to use telehealth when necessary to ensure services to clients, a continuity to services to clients, and maintain staffing levels that are required. House Section 10 and Senate Section 11, these sections modify the medical assistance coverage requirements for services delivered through telehealth in medical assistance. And these would be services, they would be the healthcare clinical services, mental health services, chemical dependency services, and substance use disorder services. What is not included in either the House or Senate are the targeted case management services. Those are dealt in another section. In these two sections, there are several differences. One of the big differences is House in the statute goes in and includes coverage for audio-only communication. And the Senate does cover audio-only communication, but for an only limited time, and how it's covered currently under the waiver that is in place due to the COVID and the emergency orders. House Section 11, Senate Section 12, these sections extend medical assistance coverage to telemonitoring services. There are slight differences between the House and Senate in terms of the specific requirements that must be met before these services are covered. House Section 12 and Senate Section 13, these sections modify the medication therapy management services to include permitting that these services may be delivered through telehealth. And these sections are identical, again, the effective date. House Section 13 and Senate Section 14, these sections clarify that the mental health case management services may be provided either in person or through interactive video. There are minor differences in these two sections. House Section 14 and Senate Section 15 create a new subdivision that describes when face-to-face contact requirements for targeted case management services may be provided through interactive video. And again, there are minor differences in these sections. House Section 15, Senate Section 16, clarify that mental health services may be provided through telehealth. These are identical sections except for the effective date. House Section 16 through 19 and 25, this is House only, and these sections modify long-term care consultation assessments and specifies criteria for the use of remote assessments. House Section 20 and Senate Section 17, these sections specify the requirements for payment for the targeted case management services when contact is through interactive video, and there are minor differences between these sections. House Section 21 and Senate Section 18, these sections specify the requirements for when face-to-face contact must be in person for child welfare targeted case management services. Again, there are minor differences. Senate Section 19, this is a Senate-only section, and it changes the terminology to refer to telehealth instead of telemedicine in this section that deals with children's therapeutic services. Senate Section 20 is again another Senate-only section, and this section specifies that a psychiatric provider may provide intensive non-residential rehabilitative mental health services through telehealth if necessary to prevent the disruption of services to clients or to maintain required psychiatric staffing levels. Senate Section 21 is again another Senate-only section, and this section specifies that the travel time is only in allowable billing for IEDPI benefits when providing in-person services. House Section 22 is a House-only section, and this section permits remote assessments for community-based service waivers for persons with disabilities. House Section 23 to 24 and Senate sections from Article 9, which is the economic supports article, sections 11, 12, 15, 17. It's my understanding that this is sort of a package and they all go together. These sections modify public assistance application procedures to permit online and telephone applications. Senate Section 22 is a Senate-only provision, and this extends the modifications and the waivers that involve expanding access to services using telehealth during COVID that were ordered by the Commissioner of Human Services in response to the governor's peacetime emergency order, that these modifications are extended to be in place until June 30th, 2023. And the House doesn't do anything with this. So their position would be these modifications and waivers would expire as they're currently set in these waivers, and that would be 60 days after the peacetime emergency order is terminated.
And Ms. Cavanaugh, if I could just interrupt you for a second on that one. Do we have a list of what those are that are not already being dealt with in the telehealth bill specifically? Are there what the additional waivers are that the House is not extending, that the Senate is extending here?
Madam Chair, I believe that we could dig that out for you in terms of what those waivers are in these other in the other documents that is specifically laid out, at least the waivers that we are extending. But it's my understanding is that everything that, you know, that the House is doing, the Senate is also extending through these waivers. But you're correct, there might be a few other things that get extended longer.
Okay, thank you.
So then going to Senate Section 23, this is Senate only. This requires DHS to study the viability of continuing the use of audio only communication as a permitted option for the delivery of services through telehealth. And House Section 26 and Senate Section 24, both the House and the Senate require the Commissioner of Health to study the impact of the telehealth payment methodologies and delivery expansion on the coverage and provision of services delivered through telehealth. And there are a number of differences in the study, including what is going to be studied. The House and the Senate have minor differences in what the study is required to look at. And another difference is when the study has to be finished and submitted to the legislature. The House, that date is February 15th, 2023, and the Senate, the date is February 15th, 2024. And then the House Section 28, Senate Section 26, these are revisor instructions and there are minor differences. And then, I think I missed House Section 27, sorry. House Section 27 is a House only, very important one. This section provides that House sections 1 through 15, 20 and 21, so the ones that are starred in the House, the section column, all of these sections expire July 1, 2023, except for the change in the definition of originating site in the medical assistance telehealth section. And Senate section 25, that is a Senate only, and that section establishes a task force on the public-private telepresence strategy. Then we've done the revisor instruction. The last sections here are the House section 29, Senate section 27. These are repealers. The same sections are repealed in both the Senate and the House. However, in the House bill, all of the sections that are repealed are then reenacted effective July 1, 2023. So with that, I think I would just mention that a number of the minor differences for the targeted case management services when we're using interactive video and when interactive video can be used for face-to-face contact, whether it has to be in person or through interactive video. I think the Senate was continuing having discussions with DHS and the counties and working out that language. So a number of those minor differences in at least those services, I believe, is just because the Senate was working on it longer. And so some of those differences got, you know, worked out in the Senate bill, but just never got into the House bill.
And Ms. Kavanagh, which section would that be here? I want to make sure.
There are a number of sections that that the ones that deal with the case management, I think, help. And 13 and 14. House section 20 and Senate section 17, House section 21, section Senate section 18. I'm assuming DHS will point those out if I'm not correct, but in there side by side. But it's really the ones that deal with the targeted case management services. These services really are being dealt with at the, you know, we work that way to the end of session, that these services would be really not dealt with the same as the telehealth, clinical, mental health, you know, substance abuse disorder services, that they really should be treated differently, and, you know, terminology should be different. That's the difference. But I think in kind of the big picture, again, the House and the Senate, especially with audio only communication for medical assistance, telehealth services, we both cover them. The House puts it in statutory language that audio only communication is covered, but then they repeal that, or they, you know, that's only effective from January 1, 2022 to July 1, 2023. The Senate covers those, you know, additions to telehealth, including audio communication. The audio communication change, at least, we do not put in the statute. We do put in statute the other modifications that go along with these waivers that are in place due to COVID. For example, expanding the providers that can offer telehealth. We get rid of the 3 times a week limit on services. We permit services, the originating site difference, and I think the House does continue that, but that allows services to be provided to enrollees when they're in their home or in their residence. But we don't specifically say in statute that audio only communications are covered for medical assistance, but we do allow that to continue as part of the waiver until July 1, 2023. And then we have that study that the Department of Human Services is gonna look at whether that's a viability in terms of making that change permanently and allowing audio communication to be a delivery method for telehealth. And that study is due at the December 31st, I believe, of 2022. So the legislature in the 2023 session would be looking at that that language determining whether that should be a permanent change or not.
So Ms. Cavanaugh, if I'm understanding correctly, I just want to be really clear on this. I know the House is sunsetting pretty much everything at the end of the 23 budget year. The Senate then is not, there's no sunset as such, but it's the audio portions that are in session law only that effectively are being sunsetted. If you could just kind of go over again where the Senate is sunsetting and what exactly they're sunsetting.
Madam Chair, the Senate isn't sunsetting really anything. We don't add that in statute. So audio only communications in medical assistance, we're not talking about the commercial market, we're talking about coverage in medical assistance, mm-hmm. that continues as it is currently offered and covered under the waiver, the COVID waiver, if you will, or the changes, modifications, and waivers due to the emergency, order and the changes due to COVID. We extend that waiver until July 1, 2023. So it is, so that would end, the audio only communication portion would end. The other modifications that are currently in place under the waiver, we do put in statute and they would not sunset. They would continue. And that again is, the expansion of, the providers of who can offer it, offer telehealth, the limiting, getting rid of the limits of the 3 times per week limit of telehealth services. And being able to provide the service in the when the enrollee is at home or in their residence.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Cavanaugh. That's very helpful. I know this is one of the big topics of the session, I think. And I know there's a lot of interest in this from providers in particular. And Senator Benson and I have had some discussion about it, and we will, I think, be continuing to work on this, and I'm sure we'll come up with a satisfactory compromise on this language. I just want to just say a few words, and then I'll turn it over to Senator Benson, kind of about what the House's intent is in this, and just frame this up because, we've talked about this through a number of committee stops, and But I just want to make sure that those watching kind of understand where we're going with this. So we do hear from providers and we do understand, I think all of us, that there's a lot we can do with telehealth and that there are big advantages in some spaces with the use of telehealth on access for patients, on really getting treatment, especially for people sometimes for whom travel is difficult. And there are many, many situations in which different aspects of telehealth can be helpful. And we know that. There's at least for me, and I think for the House, there's also a lot of unknowns out there about exactly where it's best used, exactly where there may be also some negative impacts of using telehealth instead of an in-person visit. And what we discovered going through this process is that at least certainly the fiscal note on this, which gives us only the state side costs, the state costs really, it is quite expensive. And so with the House's delayed effective date, the reason for that was purely fiscal. That on our spreadsheet, and we're spending only surplus money here, or money that is available to us in our target. We're not making use of any of the federal money to put our budget together here, at least in this portion. It is quite expensive, and so when we set the delayed effective date, we were doing that on the assumption that the emergency powers, or the emergency, I should say, would continue, and that the waivers would be in place until the first of the year, when our bill would take over and we were able to save some money on our spreadsheet. That is, we have heard that, you know, there's a lot of concern about gaps, and we now understand, in fact, that the waivers will expire on July 1st. So we do need to figure out how to pay for this. And of course, we in this committee don't have a budget target yet. We don't know what we're going to be able to do and what money we're going to be able to use ultimately. But I think, you know, certainly the House is not looking to have things expire and then start up again. That was a fiscal decision that we made at the time based on information that we had. In terms of the sunset and the study date, our intention was, again, the tails, the ongoing costs for a lot of this are quite high. And we right now don't feel that we have all the information we need to make the best permanent decisions on what to do about some of these issues. So there's no doubt that audio only, or, you know, using a phone call is can be a great assist in a lot of circumstances. However, there are big questions about it. Should it be paid for at the same rate as an in-person visit, for example? Or maybe that should happen for some kinds of care and not for other kinds of care. So there are just still a lot of questions and unknowns. And the Department of Human Services did do some study of this issue. And as they presented it in our committee, they had hoped, of course, to be able to make comparisons after the end of the pandemic so that we'd see how utilization is going when after the pandemic is over and things more or less return to normal and be able to look back. And of course, that all didn't happen. So we're all really working still with kind of limited information. And our hope in the way we structured the sunset in the bill was not to make anything in particular go away at the end of 2020, at the end of our next budget year. And you'll notice that our sunset here is, which is for July 1st of 23. That would be after the legislature had another opportunity to take a good look and make some adjustments. So it wasn't an intention to make this all go away, certainly, just to give us all the opportunity and the encouragement to really take a close look at what's going on and have more data. And our point in having our study come back to us on February 15th, 2023 was exactly that, so that we would get information, hopefully good information that we could then use to make more finely tuned decisions about how things move forward. So just with that explanation, I'm going to go to Senator Benson. I'm sure she has a lot more to say about this as well. And then we also, I see that Senator Abler has his hand up, and we'll go to him next. Senator Benson.
Not a lot more to say. You covered things well. There are differences in House-Senate telemonitoring. I have to gain a better grasp on what that means. Dates are really important, and it is a difference. So thank you for acknowledging. We don't want to sunset and leave a gap. And so I think that we can resolve in a very straightforward way. Some of the dates that we need to think about, yes, the legislative calendar, but also the plan year for our contracts with PMAP. To what extent will there be interactivity there? But more importantly, the individual market plan year, where they start structuring plans in May, and then they have to send to Department of Commerce in July, I believe it is, and then finalize for the fall. And so as we set dates, if it expires, and this is a lack of understanding on my part, if a provision expires in the middle of a plan year, are they supposed to then change, or does that apply at the beginning of the plan year? And I'm sure there are folks watching this right now who are going to explain to me exactly how that works. So let's just be cognizant of plan year impact as we're setting dates. So they start structuring their plans somewhat before we end our legislative session, and just to be aware, there's also a contract cycle. A concern of mine with leaving parity in place is that it might interfere with the ability to make innovative value-based reimbursement. Parity is an important provision to Senator Rosen. So I want to think about what the contracting cycle between a health plan and a hospital or a provider might be. And it's my understanding that many times they're a 3-year cycle. So are we allowing value-based reimbursement in an expanded telehealth universe to get tested over a long enough contract cycle? It's a question, it's not a stopping point. And then are we going to have, as you raised, sufficient non-COVID telehealth data in order to make decisions if we do a short time frame? I don't know if a year is enough, if we need 18 months or 2 years. So I wanna think about that when we set sunsets. There does need to be a sunset, at least on a few provisions, to make the legislature stop and take a look at this. The most problematic challenge we will have is how we fit innovation within a target that we're given, the Senate provision with the broad audio only allowance is expensive in the first biennium. And so in order to retain audio only going forward, we're gonna have to see value somewhere else in the market, in outcomes. And we can only do this if it is better for patients, a good value, higher quality. It's gotta meet two of the three at least. So that's my assessment. It is really nice to see identical except for the enactment date on so many of these provisions. Thank you, Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. And I do want to acknowledge too, this bill was Kelly Morrison's, Representative Dr. Kelly Morrison's bill in the House and Senator Rosen's bill, I think, in the Senate, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, neither of them are here on this conference committee, but of course, you know, they'll be important partners as we go forward and try to work out some of these differences. And thank you for that. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the discussion, and I'll be pretty brief. I just had a couple of points I wanted to pile on with you all. The one thing about, there's several things. One is about networks. And plans allowed to negotiate. I think it's really important that we retain the good relationships we have with people's local providers. I'm very concerned as we allow whoever to establish a network that they get to pick from, calling that the same as what they had before, that it's not going to be, you know, five doctors in London or somewhere where they've got some contracted group, and it's just not. So I'm just very concerned about that, and nothing against London, Madam Chair. On the topic of parity, we discussed this a little bit yesterday about remote services for the DTNHs and employment services, et cetera. And I think it's important to consider that. I know Senator Rosen and I have talked about this a bit. And if we're ever gonna save money in healthcare, if truly it's less expensive to do it somewhere, and no clinician wants to get a lower rate. Like, oh, they want parity but the horse is out of the barn. There's no, we're not ever going back to how it was. And so if they think no one's going to choose it to come in their homes, they're totally wrong. In fact, many on the mental health side, as you know, Madam Chair, and even the substance abuse folks prefer doing it from their house. They don't want to go out, and maybe they don't even have a car, or it's inconvenient, and they can just keep their appointments. The reports are that appointments are being kept better. And we know a lot of these conditions that and challenges people have, they need the consistent work done. And then, so that's, I mean, an open issue, but it's an important one. And we spend a ton of money on healthcare, the most in the world, for some of the most, you know, marginal outcomes sometimes. And then finally, on the cost of the phone deal, that's a reflection of people that have been underserved. And so if it costs a lot more, then that means the people weren't following through, and that there's going to be a big demand for this. And we've discussed that some people don't have access to a nice phone like you and I have. Here I'm walking on my clinic with my phone. And so I think it's important to try to solve it. And I think everything everybody has said makes all the sense in the world. And I'm happy that this is being debated on a policy basis and that there's no, you know, stripes on any of this, but it's about what's best. And I wanted to thank you for that, but express those few points. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Well, thank you, Senator Abler. And you remind me to sort of make the statement that, you know, the fact that we have these provisions that kind of line up doesn't mean that there won't be further work on some of this. And I do want to mention that Legal Aid has weighed in with what I think are some very helpful suggestions. And we'll, you know, be looking, we'll be discussing how, whether we can incorporate some of those. And so this is one of the these large policy discussions in the legislature. It kind of keeps getting worked on and worked on and worked on. And I feel very good about, you know, that we all are kind of sharing the same goals here. I mean, that we want this to work for people. We want it. We have these kind of, you know what we, I talked about, you know, how we know that this does expand access for a lot of people, just as you said, Senator Abler. I mean, obviously it does show that we're underserving people that oftentimes, you know, but there's a kind of a parallel concern to that too, that we don't want to create a two-tiered system where one person, maybe a wealthier person, gets a visit and another person who's not so wealthy or lives in, you know, they only can have a phone call. I mean, not that anyone wants that to happen, but we just want to move carefully here so that we actually are making improvements to our system and helping patients and, you know, the quality, the cost and the access. Yeah, we want to maximize as much of that as we can. And we just, you know, as a policymaker, I feel a little bit ill-equipped right now to do that. And so that's kind of behind our effort to kind of continue things for a period of time and try to collect more information. And a lot of this discussion, kind of my reaction to a lot of what Senator Benson was saying is a lot of this, so much of this is going to depend on what finances we have available for it, right? Because we were all, I think, quite surprised by how expensive it is to do these services. And that may very well reflect under the people are underserved, and we don't want them to be underserved, but we also want to make sure that they're served with good quality services that create good outcomes, most importantly. So Senator Abler, and then back to Senator Benson.
Thank you. And actually we're tracking well in the conversation. I was going to mention, it's too bad that the cost of increased utilization doesn't get reflected like in savings and somewhere else. And so the presumption in the fiscal note is we're going to just pour services into people and nothing good is going to happen that's going to change their life. They're not going to stay at work more. They're not going to, you know, not go on some program that might be a fail-safe program. They may not go to the hospital, which we're going to maybe pay for. And so I was hoping with the Legislative Budget Office, there might be some more dynamic fiscal noting where they actually give it a thought that if we did this, something's not going to happen. And I don't know, we're the people that set up all these practices and policies. And again, here we are stymied. And you and I know that if we let 100 people have a phone call over a period of time, that the outcomes are gonna be much better than if they didn't have a chance to get that phone call. And it would, so where's the offsetting benefit? And so I guess that's, at this point, Madam Chair, it's just rhetorical because I've said it 10 more times and I'll say it 100 times before, I'll say it 10 more times, but this is purely just wrong that we have to pay for what we know is going to save money. And then the savings show up in the forecast so we can go buy roads or something with it. So thanks, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator Abler. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Abler's point, perhaps we need to put some capture language in so that if there is reduced emergency room use, it gets put someplace so that we can look at it and note that there was actually a savings and it didn't just fall to the bottom line. But I am very much in line with, if this is going to help patients, then it should show up as a financial benefit somewhere. If you can call your provider
for a scheduled appointment and have better compliance, it reduces the risk that you'll be in the emergency department. Or if you can do a call with your regular primary care provider when you can't get into the office, and it reduces you going to an urgent care. We should see some of that showing up in here. Just non-medical emergency or non-emergency medical transportation savings for those people who opt to have a from home visit should show up in the fiscal note. And so what we're seeing in the fiscal note for the expansion of these services is that the people who scored this don't think it will make any difference in the system. And I haven't talked to a single person who actually believes that.
Well, thanks, Senator. I mean, we're kind of debating that age-old philosophical conundrum that we always have in health and human services, right? This issue around dynamic scoring, or can we count the savings from better results? And yeah, it's always a frustration. I know every session we end up discussing this, and it never really does go away. And I think part of the, it would be wonderful if we could capture the savings. But of course, we know that everything is multifactorial, right? So we know that in 2020, we had way reduced utilization of health services. And a lot of that actually helped build our budget surplus, because we were using a lot less Medicaid money for that, for services. Was that because people were healthier? Well, probably not. It was because of the pandemic and resistance to going to physicians, or partly when services weren't available because of executive orders and so on. So it's often really hard, if we could tease out what the impact is of some particular policy. But I don't think it's really a given that if people can get a phone call that it will result in some reduced utilization elsewhere. That's really the question. I mean, we could probably surmise that in certain services that would be the case, but maybe not in all services. And that's where I'm really, I know it's very ambitious, and I know our timeline's really short for the study. We're not going to have all the information we need, certainly before the 23 budget session. But I'm hoping we'll have at least better decision-making tools available to us, more information, so that we can say, yes, we should have parity in this service, but not that service, perhaps, or, you know, based on some outcome data. So, you know, it's like common knowledge isn't really, we all kind of surmise that this is what it will be in that, but of course, that doesn't always turn out to be the case. So yeah, we're all sort of suffering from the same malady here, I think. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it really brings me joy to hear you guys having this conversation about, I mean, this is true innovation and true looking at how the system should be evolving. And it reminds me back in the early 2000s, Madam Chair and members, there was a Dr. Jeff Schiff and the Pediatric Quality Control Council, when medical home was being touted, they brought forward some information they had done with a data study, was that when you utilize comprehensive, coordinated, and collaborative care, the primary care work at it, you actually saw a decrease in the use of the emergency room. That, because of that, it got, you know, our system then set up, I think they called it healthcare homes, Madam Chair. I think you were part of that conversation with then Senator Abler was then, you know, in the other house. But here's what it did, is that we knew that there were captured savings, all right? We just couldn't book those, but it did cause the system to move to a better direction. And I think the same thing here, we know that there's gonna be cost savings, because right now you look at mobility, access to transportation, this is really creating a flexible system where the system is going to be able to say, I'm addressing the unique needs of the individual, because I know that mobility and access to transportation is an issue. And I'll guarantee you this, that we're going to see some cost savings. And I'm so glad to hear you guys talking about, how do you book that? How do you find that? How do you mark that? So I just encourage that conversation going on, and I'm glad we're having this today in that. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So any other discussion? We're going to, of course, continue this discussion offline and try to get to some conclusions. And of course, we won't, we'll come back and discuss it again. I mean, this is obviously, there's a lot of public interest and need for visibility, transparency on this whole discussion. Okay, any other comments on this or questions that any members have? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So this was really a good discussion. Appreciate that, members. Okay, so I think we may be able to end a little bit early here. I want to give Senator Benson an opportunity to discuss tomorrow's meeting. I assume we're going to meet tomorrow. Our slot is 1 to 4. Senator Benson, anything you want to put out there?
Madam Chair, I believe we're going to notice the meeting from 11 to, we're going to have a short meeting tomorrow. Article 15, and this will be contingent on, the House had some technical questions on Article 15. If we can clear that up, we could adopt that and then go through background studies, which is in Senator Abler's jurisdiction, but is important for us to get through. And so I'm not saying everything's contingent, but if we can get those two items settled out, would be my preference to meet earlier in the day without being obnoxiously early.
Oh, okay. Senator Benson, my understanding is that the slots are set because of our media folks and kind of carefully. I think we could easily have a shorter meeting within our time slot. I'm not sure we are allowed to move it earlier, but I'll leave that to you and your staff if you find that that's doable. Let's see, I'm just checking right now on my calendar and, you know, I could certainly start a bit earlier, but we'll wait to see the public notice on that and just everybody should watch. It's a good flag that it might start earlier. And so people should note that and be looking for it.
And Madam Chair, if it's going to be a lovely Saturday, earlier is better than later. And so we're going to see if language can be ready for adoption of the articles, that Article 15.
Okay, well, thank you. All right. Any other questions or comments before we adjourn for the day? Not seeing any. So thank you, everyone. Thank you for attending today and for the good discussion. And with that, we are adjourned.